But let's move on to the greatest of the church fathers and to the greatest apologist of early Christianity. This is, of course, Augustine. Augustine, not Augustine. Augustine is a city in Florida. We are talking not about a city in Florida. We are talking about the church father, Augustine. Mispronounce it and you'll flunk on that ground alone. I've almost decided to give an oral examination just to check that out. Now, what is the approach of Augustine, who is 5th century, to the apologetic task? First of all, as you might well expect, Augustine uses the arguments from miracle and from prophecy that are employed by his predecessors. Here is what Augustine says in his City of God, along the line of what we've already been discussing. This is in the City of God, chapter 22, section 5. He's speaking to someone who objected to gospel miracles. And I quote, "Very well, if you say that they did not happen, you must then admit that it is a much bigger miracle that the disciples of Christ should have converted the world without miracles than with them." Unquote. Very well, if you say that the miracles did not happen, you must then admit that it is a much bigger miracle that the disciples of Christ should have converted the world without them than with them. Unquote. That's not bad, because again, when you look at the picture of the apostles in the New Testament, are these the people to have managed a general conversion of the Roman Empire without any supernatural aid? Not hardly. There is a tract that was produced some years ago having to do with starting a corporation, this as an analogy to starting the church. And the question was, would anybody have chosen that group of 12 as the board of directors? And the answer, very definitely not. They just don't seem to have the wherewithal to pull it off. These are not great strategists, great tacticians. They are not world religious leaders or the like. They really need something. What they need is 100% God's grace. That's what they need. And isn't that exactly what the Bible says, that the Lord chooses the weak things of this world to confound the wise? Why did He choose the Israelites? Because they were Near Eastern religious geniuses? In the 19th century, you know, the liberal theological establishment wrote books with such titles as The Religious Genius of the Israelites. And these books purported to describe the great sense of religious consciousness that the Israelites developed, how much more religious geniuses they were than other Near Eastern peoples. Well, this is just absurd. Just absurd. The Israelites were 180 degrees removed from the status of religious geniuses. They had a kind of national foot-in-the-mouth disease through Old Testament times. No matter what the Lord does for them, they don't appreciate it. And the Lord has to whack them back into line again and again and again. Here He brings them out of Egypt, out of sheer grace, division of the Red Sea. Out they go. There they are in the wilderness. And He's providing them with manna. Down the stuff comes, and in the morning all they have to do is gather it up and they have to eat it. What do? They do two things. First of all, they try to can it. They try to can it, for goodness sake, so that they won't have to go out in the morning and bother to pick it up. What they want is a religious insurance policy. They want to get this stuff under their control so they are not dependent on the Lord. They want to turn the thing from grace into a work where they can plan, work with the stuff in that sense. And then secondly, they want something else to eat. They loathe this light bread, the text says. They wanted champignon and Chateaubriand. They weren't satisfied with what the Lord was sending down. Now that's the kind of people that were chosen as the vehicle of revelation. Why? So that nobody could make any serious claim that they had created this religion themselves. The whole idea is that when you look in the Old Testament, you're supposed to say, "Great Scott! This must have come from God. Those people certainly couldn't have managed it." And the same idea with the apostles in the New Testament. That's exactly the idea that you're supposed to get, so that it's perfectly plain that it's by grace. Well, Augustine makes a good point then, but Augustine developed a system of Christian apologetics, which we want to look into in quite a bit of detail. This is the first articulate, full-orbed system of Christian apologetics in the history of the church. And it gets a bit complicated, but it's very, very important for us to understand this. The first thing to note is that Augustine was converted to Christianity out of Neoplatonism. Out of Neoplatonism. N-E-O-P-L-A-T-O-N-I-S-M. Neoplatonism. Neoplatonism was a mystical variation on Platonism. And by Platonism, we mean the philosophy of Plato. In Augustine's time, Platonic philosophy was at the top of the heap. Anyone who was anyone philosophically or intellectually was a Platonist. And by Platonist in Augustine's time was meant generally this mystical variation on Platonism. Plato had stressed the intellectual faculty. The Neoplatonists didn't neglect that, but they emphasized a mystical dimension. But let's get a picture of what Platonism was at the beginning. Plato gives an expression to what comes to be known as classical idealism. Classical idealism. Plato's thinking is the great example and the first well-articulated example of classical idealism. The term idealism is one that can be misunderstood easily, because we think today of an idealist as an unrealistic sort of fellow, as the person who wanders around without any practical sense. You go home from seminary on your vacation, and Uncle Oswald says, "Well, my boy, what have you been studying up there?" And you say, "I've been studying apologetics." And Uncle Oswald says, "Son, that isn't going to help you build a bridge. That's just not realistic." See? Uncle Oswald, therefore, is of the opinion that you are nothing but an idealistic dreamer. You're working with stuff that doesn't have any practical impact. But that isn't the meaning of the term idealism in its historical sense. An idealist, historically, was a person who felt that ideas were the only things of ultimate importance. Ideas are set over against the ordinary world of phenomena. Plato put it this way, and of course Plato is picking up and developing the philosophy of Socrates, and it's impossible really to distinguish the two of these because they are blended together and come to us in Plato's dialogues. Says Plato, ideas are the only things of ultimate significance. Everything you come across in this grubby world is less than perfect. Here we have a book, which obviously is close to perfection since it's one of mine, but it isn't perfect. There are undoubtedly typographical errors in it. There might even be a poor binding at some points, and there are those who've even suggested there might be some slight flaws in the reasoning at some points, but of course we don't need to go that far. The thing is that no matter how you look at this book, it doesn't quite reach perfection. But you can imagine what an ideal book would be like. You can imagine it without any of those imperfections. Think of it another way. And Plato particularly used mathematical examples. You can try your best to draw a perfect triangle, and you will work yourself blue doing this, but you will never be able to draw a perfect triangle. No matter how carefully you do it, if you examine it under a microscope, it won't turn out to be perfect. Just increase the magnification of the microscope, and no matter how carefully you do it, you still won't arrive at perfection. Yet, you know what a perfect triangle would consist of. You know what it would consist of, and it can be described mathematically. The point is, though, that you can't actually do it. Where is the perfect triangle? The perfect triangle, says Plato, is only existent in the world of ideas. But that shows that the world of ideas is the only thing of real importance. If it weren't for an existent ideal triangle, you couldn't conceive of triangles in general, and you wouldn't know how to do an approximate one. The ideal precedes and gives meaning to the phenomena of experience. Now, for Plato, you approach the ideal primarily by ratiocination, by intellectualizing, by thinking. The world of ideas contacts this world by way of the human mind. Thus, this position is often called rational idealism. Rational idealism. The mind conceiving of and tying in with the ideal. The term ideal and the term idea are synonymous in Plato. Because that's what ideals are. They are ideas. All right. You arrive at these by thinking. But Plato recognized that our thinking is not always clear. Our thinking is influenced negatively by our environment and by our weaknesses. He presents the famous image of the cave in the Republic. He says the human race is like people chained in a cave, and they are chained so that they cannot see the sun outside of the cave. They're chained backwards from the entrance, and all they can see is the flickering of firelight on the opposite wall. The fire is reflective of the sun, but they can't even see that. What they see are the shadows on the wall. And if only it were possible to cut these chains so that they could turn around and see the fire and move out of the cave into the sunlight, then they'd see things as they really are. The flickering shadows represent this world and our images of it. And these images are only partial reflections of the world of ideas. How can we do this? How can we find our way to the ideal? Well, primarily by our intellectual effort, but Plato recognized that we aren't able to get that full distance. And so he says there will need to be a mystical jump. There is a mystical jump involved. For him, the mystical jump was relatively slight. And that's the difference between the Neoplatonists who come after him and Plato. The Neoplatonists emphasize the mystical end of it. They say the only way you can get into contact with the ideal is by a kind of Eastern mysticism in which you separate yourself from the world of phenomena and you enter into the mystical experience of the ideal. Probably the most famous of the Neoplatonists was Porphyry, P-O-R-P-H-R-Y, but the Jewish thinker Philo was a Neoplatonist as well and had influence, P-H-I-L-O, Philo. Interestingly enough, Plato is one of the most attractive philosophers of the ancient world. In my book, The Shape of the Past, I cite a passage from Plato's Phaedo, P-H-A-E-D-O, and In this book, Plato says, I've done the very best I can in my philosophizing. If only I had a raft of revelation to carry me over the seas of doubt. If only I had a raft of revelation to carry me over the seas of doubt. There's a great philosopher who recognizes that he can only go so far, and he realizes there would have to be something coming down from above in order to answer the ultimate questions he's not able to take care of. Now, this is so different from most thinkers in the history of philosophy who get the idea that they have managed to describe the universe in its very essence. The greatest modern idealistic philosopher is Hegel in the 19th century, and Hegel really thought that he had the universe by its metaphysical tail, and how different from the humility of a Plato. Well, everybody thought Platonic at the time of Augustine. This was just about at the time when Rome was ceasing to be a world power. The fall of Rome was imminent. Rome had been sacked in 410, and at this point in the history of the ancient world, Platonic philosophy in its Neoplatonic phase was considered the most significant. All right, Augustine becomes a Christian. The incident by which he became a Christian is worth recounting very briefly. He realized he had to make a move, but he was putting it off. And one day he was sitting in his garden, and he had a scroll of scripture there, and the little girl in the next yard was playing a child's game, and she was saying, "Tola lege, tola lege, tola lege," you know, as children do in a sing-song game. Those words in Latin mean take and read, take and read, take and read. And Augustine heard this, and so he picked up the scroll and he opened it at random, and there he read, "Not in strife or in wantonness, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the things of the flesh to satisfy the lusts thereof." And Augustine was stricken on the spot, and there he became a Christian. He recounts this in his Confessions, which of course is translated into English in a number of different versions and is well worth reading. It's from the Confessions that the prayer I gave at the beginning of the class period comes. All right, Augustine then moves from Neoplatonism to Christianity, and he recognizes that the predominant philosophical position in his day is Platonism. So he develops an apologetic to those people who are influenced by Platonism as he was. Augustine believed that Plato was the greatest of the philosophers of the ancient world. He believed that Plato had worshipped the true God. He says in his City of God, in Augustine's City of God, "It is evident that none of the philosophers come nearer to us than the Platonists." Come nearer to us as Christians than the Platonists. That's in Book 8, Chapter 5. And also he says, "The Platonists are," quote, "the noblest of the philosophers," unquote. That's in the City of God, Book 10, Chapter 1. Augustine was convinced that Plato had helped to move him toward Christianity. How did Augustine then develop an apologetic in reference to Platonism? He begins with the operations of the mind. And he says, "My doubting, the fact that I doubt, indicates that I exist. By doubting, it's plain that my mind is operating." What he's saying here is a variant of what the philosopher Descartes says in the 17th century. Descartes in the 17th century says, "Cogito ergo sum," I think, therefore I am. What Augustine is saying is, "Dubito ergo sum," I doubt, therefore I am. This is not bad as a starting point for people who might doubt their own existence. The very fact that they are doubting makes a fairly strong case that they're there to doubt, eh? Ha! Yes. For Augustine, the way to truth is not through the senses. It isn't examining data out here in the world. Instead, it's a matter of analyzing how you think and what that involves. Says he in his book, The True Religion, chapter 39, section 72, quote, "Do not go outside. Come back into your very own self. Truth dwells in the inner man." Unquote. Now that statement has given some lame-brained interpreters of Augustine the idea that he was a subjectivist, that what he's saying is, wallow around in your own emotions and you will find something. Well, yes, but usually it isn't very pleasant. You know the difference between a psychoanalyst and a coal miner, don't you? No? Well, the psychoanalyst goes down deeper, stays down longer, and comes up dirtier than the coal miner. Those who slosh around in their own emotive life usually find that they have learned more about themselves than they wish they knew, and they certainly have not found any solutions. Augustine is not saying that. One of the philosophers who utterly misinterprets Augustine is the German philosopher Windelband, who fortunately is not too well known. Windelband said of Augustine that he maintained a metaphysics of subjectivity. A metaphysics of subjectivity. Nonsense! There isn't anything subjective about what Augustine is saying at all. He's talking about getting back into your own mental operations. He's not playing psychoanalyst in the 5th century or anything like that. For Augustine, it's in the mind and not in the senses that the criteria of truth will be found. Augustine is a rationalist in the sense of Plato. He's a rational idealist. Well, when you begin examining your thinking, see, you've admitted that you exist because you're doubting. Now you begin examining your thinking, and what do you find? You find that your thinking involves innate ideas. Innate ideas. Nobody ever taught them to you, but they are already there. They are part of you. What kind of ideas? Ideas of perfection. That's what kind of ideas. Perfect triangles, perfect books, perfect briefcases, perfect automobiles, perfect wives, etc. The idea of perfection is built in. Nobody had to teach it to you. It's very interesting that in one of Plato's dialogues, this is in the Meno, Plato tries to show that geometry is already resident in people as an innate idea. And he takes a slave in the Meno, and he asks the slave questions. The slave doesn't know anything about geometry at all. He asks the slave questions, and by asking him the right questions, the slave builds up the structure of geometry. It already was there. And Plato is convinced that the function of a teacher is primarily that of an intellectual midwife. He uses that expression, the maieutic method. The word maieutic in Greek means midwifery. The technique of a teacher, according to Plato, is that of a midwife, where you're bringing the baby out. The baby's already there. It's already innate because human beings are simply structured that way. Well, what kind of innate ideas of perfection are there in people? Primarily, the idea of the good, the idea of the true, and the idea of the beautiful. The good, the true, and the beautiful. The good is the moral ideal. The true is the epistemological ideal. There's a cutie. That word you must get familiar with. We'll be using it constantly. It's simply a word referring to truth. Epistemological. E-P-I-S-T-E-M-O-logical. L-O-G-I-C-A-L. And the beautiful is the aesthetic ideal. There is an ethical ideal already in people. There is an epistemological ideal, an ideal having to do with truth, and an aesthetic ideal, an ideal that has to do with beauty. And here, says Augustine, you've arrived at God whether you knew it or not. Because without a divine perfection, you wouldn't have these perfections. Indeed, those perfections could only coexist in a God. God and perfect morality implicate each other. They require each other. God and truth implicate each other. God and perfect beauty implicate each other. You can't have one without the other, though Augustine had not gone to a performance of Annie Get Your Gun. What we have here is a kind of expression of what later will be called the ontological argument. The ontological argument. Jot that down because we'll be talking about that later on this evening. Ontological. O-N-T-O, logical. Ontological argument. That means an argument from being. An argument from being. This is what Augustine says in the Confessions, Book 7, Section 4. Quote, "For never yet was, nor will be, a soul able to conceive of anything better than thou, who art the highest and best good." Unquote. "For never yet was, nor will be, a soul able to conceive of anything better than thou, who art the highest and best good." What Augustine is saying is, when you have conceived of perfection, you have arrived at God, because that's what God is. It would be impossible to conceive of anything beyond that. Thus, you are already at the absolute. Now, at the same time, says Augustine, all begins in faith. All begins in faith. And Augustine's actual statement of his position is credo ut intellegam. Credo, again, C-R-E-D-O. Then ut, U-T, and then intellegam, I-N-T-E-L-L-E-G-A-M. I-N-T-E-L-L-E-G-A-M. I believe in order that I may understand. I believe to understand. Notice that intellegam, understand, is the rational function. That's what we've been talking about. But, says Augustine, in order to arrive here, I must believe. Believing stands prior to all of it. Reason is the handmaid of faith. You say, but wait a minute, how can that be? Because we started out with reasoning, we didn't start out with faith. How can Augustine suddenly tell us that faith is the beginning of the whole business? Well, for Augustine, human knowledge can be called discovery from our standpoint. The process that we just went through from doubting to the ideal, to God. That's discovery from our standpoint. But all of it really comes from divine illumination. It's God's illumination that gives this to us, after all. For Augustine, there are no brute facts. There are no neutral facts. There aren't any facts out there that you can simply use to arrive at God. Nor, indeed, are there any brute facts really in your mind by which you can. Everything is given by God. It's His illumination. There isn't any neutral truth. And then, finally, Augustine points out that our very being pushes toward the faith that is the other side of the coin of rational idealism. Our whole being pushes toward this, our whole self. And this is the point of his great prayer in the Confession. Thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. That there is a restlessness built in, and that restlessness can only be satisfied on the basis of proper faith, and proper faith will turn out to be the other side of the coin of our rational realization of God. This restlessness of the heart has often been called the theory of the God-shaped blank. The theory of the God-shaped blank, B-L-A-N-K. That is to say, in each person, there is a piece missing, a blank, piece missing. And there's only one thing that will take care of that, and that's the piece of the right shape. And that piece is the Christian message. Putting it dramatically and sermonically, each man's life is like a picture puzzle. And he puts it together as best he can. And if he succeeds in getting the whole thing together, there will be a missing piece, and the missing piece is in the shape of a cross. And until that cross is put in there, the life just won't cohere. It'll fragment, inevitably. It requires that missing piece, and the missing piece is only of a particular shape, the restlessness of the human heart. All right, now what do we have to say to this system? We have exposited it. Now we want to do a wee bit of critique of it. We've already noted that the success of an apologetic system does not have to do with whether it can provide an absolute defense of the Christian faith. Because apologetics is always a bridge between the eternally veracious scriptures and a changing situation. Since the situation changes, since ideas change and thought patterns change and philosophies change and the sociological climate changes, apologetics is always a field needing repristination. It needs to be reworked constantly so that the needs of the day are handled properly. Because of this, we cannot demand of any system, nor will we demand of any system through the periods that we talk about, that it be an absolute system equally appropriate to all times and places. So the critique that I present should not be regarded as an attempt to put down Augustine for not offering the perfect apologetic system. What we're going to try to do is to show where he runs into difficulty philosophically, and therefore where it's difficult for us to approach the apologetic task in the same way. But quite obviously, if you run across any rational idealists, you have here the most remarkable apologetic to that approach that's ever been done. The problem is that there are not a vast number of rational idealists around any longer. There aren't very many Platonists. There are some, but there are not a lot. It is not a dominant philosophical position in the modern world. But let's look at it from a critical standpoint, having said that. Rational idealism, as a philosophy, leaves a great deal to be desired. What's the problem with it? Well, it isn't that there aren't innate ideas. There certainly are innate ideas. But the problem is, what do they really consist of? What do they really consist of? Are innate ideas anything other than purely formal? Purely formal. Meaning, are they anything other than abstract concepts? Do they really have any content to them? Do people come into the world with a complete set of innate ideas showing perfection at all points? Does your kid arrive in the world with the idea of a perfect briefcase? embedded somewhere in his mental fiber. Chances are pretty slim that that's the case. It seems more likely that people pick up such ideas from experience. How do they learn about briefcases, why they get hit over the head with them, you know, and when you're hit over the head with it, you say, "What's that?" And the person says, "That's a briefcase, and that's what I'm going to hit you with the next time." And by the time you've been hit over the head with a briefcase two or three times, you realize that that's a briefcase. And you may very well generalize among the various briefcases with which you've been hit to the fact that some are better than others, although all briefcases are equal, some are more equal than others, and therefore there is a notion that you could call the ideal briefcase. It doesn't seem as if there are innate ideas dealing with the stuff of the world. The innate ideas, rather, are of such a sort that they deal with formalities, not substance or content. For example, in the 18th century, Kant, the philosopher Kant, spelled K-A-N-T, Immanuel Kant, very unfortunate first name, but anyway, Kant set forth the notion that innate ideas consist of formal concepts, time and space, the mathematical axioms. These are part of the sum and substance of you when you come into the world. And that seems quite reasonable. Nobody has to teach you the notion of duration or the notion of extension. Duration and extension don't have to be taught to you. You already are aware of these ahead of time. But all the particular things in the world, all the stuff, the gook, the materia, what you bump up against in the world, that you learn about from experience. It's never been able to be proved that people come into the world with any inherent knowledge of things, though they do have an inherent pattern of formal structures. For example, people already know how to reason. Huh? Logic is built in. Logic is built in. Extension, duration are built in. Formal concepts like that. Now, if this is the case, then you aren't going to be able to move from your ideas of perfection to an existent God, because you would be moving from the completely formal to the substantival. You'd be going from formality to substance. It would be sort of like putting abstract concepts into a machine and having something concrete drop out of the bottom of it. This is a distinction which has been made very strongly in analytical philosophy in our century, in analytical philosophy. The analytical philosophers have made a distinction between the purely formal and the substantive. They call the purely formal the analytical, and they call the substantive the synthetic. And they emphasize that mathematics is completely formal. We talked about this last time just a bit. Mathematics is completely formal. Your concepts in Euclid, in geometry, don't have to do with the world necessarily. They have to do with an axiom set that you agree on to begin with, and then everything deduces from it. But you could have many different axiom sets like that. This is very different from talking about the stuff of the world, books and briefcases and cars and things like that. Those things can only be discovered by investigation. You've got to check the world to find them. You can't find them already in your mind. But the God of the Christian faith is not a God of pure formality. God is not like an axiom in geometry. He isn't like a mathematical proof. He isn't like a concept of extension or duration. He's a living person. and thus to try to come to him by rational thought is going to be very difficult. Augustine picked up from Plato, Plato's skepticism of the senses. Plato was very doubtful about the ability of the senses to get you anywhere. That's a characteristic of classical Greek philosophy. The classical Greek philosophers have a certain suspicion of the senses. Even Aristotle, who developed the first biological classifications, botanical classifications, is hesitant in these areas, and especially Plato. But that skepticism of the senses really isn't warranted. The philosophers of the Golden Age picked this up in part from Zeno, the pre-Socratic philosopher. Zeno, Z-E-N-O. Zeno is the one who set forth those jolly paradoxes, like the paradox of Achilles and the tortoise, you know? Said he, the tortoise could never win in the first place, because in order to get to the goal, he would first have to pass the hare, right? The tortoise and the hare. He'd have to pass the hare, right? And in order to pass the hare, he'd have to cover half the distance before he covered all the distance. But before he covered half of that distance, he'd have to cover half of that, right? And before he could cover that, he'd have to cover half of that. In other words, before he could even move, he'd have to cover half of that. And so, said Zeno, the whole idea of duration or extension is irrational, and we can't trust our senses when we see that people are moving around, because really you could never move, even the slightest bit, without first of all covering half of that distance. Well, that's a paradox, and it's an irrational notion, too. But the philosophers of the classical world were too ready to accept that kind of argument. And to feel that the senses were unreliable. But if you're going to discover a God, you're going to have to rely upon your senses if your God is real, because your God is going to be appearing to you if he's around. If, of course, you're satisfied with a completely formal God, if you feel that the axiom set of Euclid can bless you real good, then you may be able to follow this sort of thing out. But if you suspect that an axiom set will not be capable of that sort of thing, and that God needs to be a person, then you're going to need to rely upon a sensory contact in order to come across him. Then, what about the idea of I believe, therefore, in order that I may understand, the credo ut intellegam. How about this business of having to believe first and then you understand? Well, it doesn't make very good apologetics, because the non-Christian, by definition, doesn't already believe. If he did, you wouldn't have a problem. You wouldn't need to defend the faith. The idea of defending the faith really presupposes somebody who doesn't already believe. Augustine took a very, very strong predestinarian approach in his theology. We won't get into this here because we're not going into his theology really, but he was a strong predestinarian. He was a double predestinarian. He influenced Calvin greatly at the time of the Reformation. And because of his predestinarian approach, Augustine emphasizes that belief has got to precede any kind of understanding at all. Now, in one sense, he's correct. Your first premises can't be proven. Your first premises can't be proven. Every system, every approach starts with unprovable axioms. That's true. And of course, it's on that basis that people like the presuppositionalists and apologetics say, all right, in that case, we'll presuppose the entire Christian faith, there we are. We're all set. And all we have to do then is to dash out and refute other people and show them that they're wrong. And then we simply slap our system with its presuppositions onto the non-Christian situation, we're all set. What this doesn't take into account is that there are two different kinds of assumptions or presuppositions or axioms that you can begin with. One kind of beginning point is to do what I just mentioned, namely, to take an entire philosophy of life and insist on that as the starting point. The trouble with that is that it becomes invincible ignorance, because you aren't opening up that system to any kind of criticism. You're importing a total truth without ever defending it or offering any arguments for it. And obviously anybody can do that, right? I mean, if you want to start out with the assumption that the Christian faith is totally true, then you can't say anything against other people who start out with the assumption that Mary Baker Glover Patterson ... Eddy means the world to them. Anybody can assume anything, and then everybody consists of irresistible forces and immovable objects. Everybody is screaming that his system is the right starting point against everybody else, and nothing is accomplished. There is another kind of starting point, and the other kind of starting point is simply to assume as unprovable your method of investigation. To start with methodological assumptions, with assumptions of method instead of assumptions of content. What do I mean by assumptions of method? Well, try these, for example. Logic. Logic. You start with logic without trying to prove it. You can't help it, as a matter of fact. You simply have to assume it in order to be able to deal with any subsequent subject. Also, you assume that there's a world out there. You assume that you're here as well. If you don't assume that you're here, or assume that your doubt is real, if you want to put it in Augustine's terms, then you can't get any farther, because anything else that you deal with will be superfluous. If there isn't any world out there, then there's no sense in investigating anything. If it's all an illusion, then don't bother with it. You might as well sleep, but of course even that would be illusory under those conditions. So you start out with that kind of assumptions of such types as those. Also, you start out with the assumption that the world is able to be investigated by collecting facts, by examining them, by subjecting them to rational analysis. Putting it in more formal terms, in more clean-cut terms, you start out with the assumptions of deduction, induction, your own existence, and the existence of the external world. You start out with induction, deduction, your own existence, and the existence of the external world. Notice the difference between assuming those things and assuming a whole view of the world. If you assume a whole view of the world, you are gratuitously taking a viewpoint without demonstrating it. But these things we've just mentioned don't have to be demonstrated, because everybody has to assume those. Then you can use those as a basis for investigating the world. In a sense, you're beginning with faith, but you're beginning with the same kind of faith everybody has to have in order to be able to do any kind of checking of the world.